I was very tempted as we approached this first Sunday in Advent in these two passages to talk to you about the translational issues around the word virgin and how the translation from Hebrew, which means young woman, was translated into Greek, which means virgin or young woman, which was translated into English as virgin, which has caused untold arguments amongst Christians and non-Christians alike for hundreds of years. I was tempted to talk to you about the translational issues around the word Jesus and how that is the Greek version of Joshua, which takes us back to the story of Joshua and Jesus being the second Joshua or the second Moses and all that. But the reality is, that's not where my heart is right now. My heart is heavy. And so today, instead of talking about the intellectualization of certain translational issues within the Old and New Testament, I want to talk to you about the events that have been unfolding in Ferguson this past week. We talked with the children today about darkness and about a new dawn's light. And in this Advent, we are focusing on light, but the reason why the word light and the metaphor for light and the references to light come up again and again and again in the New Testament is because there is so much focus on darkness and what that means. So I want to talk to you for a little bit about the political climate that was present at the time these passages were written. At that time in Jerusalem, the Roman Empire was in charge. They were the biggest, most powerful nation on the planet, much like the United States is today. And within their borders, amongst the nations that they had conquered, lived a series of smaller nation states that were now subject to Rome, even though they were from different backgrounds, different religions, different ethnicities. And in Jerusalem and Judea at that time, where the largest concentration of Jewish people lived, there was a ruling class called the Herods. Now, we've heard about the Herods before. King Herod features prominently in the story of Christ's birth. Remember, King Herod is the one that tried to get the three wise men to tell him where Jesus was born because he wanted to go do something about that. He didn't like having another king threatening his kingship. He's the one that ordered the slaughter of all the little baby boys under the age of two. This is King Herod. And they were a real people. The Herods were a real family. They were a real ruling family. And at the time of Christ's birth, there was a man named Herod Archelaus in power. Herod the Great was his father. Herod Archelaus was just as bad as Herod. And a few things you need to know about the Herods. First of all, they were not ethnically Jewish. They converted in because they wanted to be able to climb the echelons of political power, and they saw a great way to do that in the nation of Israel. Because the people were vulnerable, because the Roman Empire promoted leaders that would be loyal to them, and because they simply saw opportunities for power and money. So they converted in and ruled over the Jewish people, even though they were not of the same background, the same ethnicity, or the same religion, because they didn't really practice what they preached. Now, Archelaus was what was called an ethnarch, very similar to a king, but without actually the title. He ruled over Judea and Samaria, and Jerusalem, which were the capital cities of what had been northern and southern Israel. So he had a lot of power over a large area, and Edom as well. He was put over Edom. Now, he came to power under some strange circumstances. At the last second before his father died, his father, it is said, changed his will. The person to come after him was supposed to be Archelaus' brother, but at the last second, under very strange, suspicious circumstances, the will was changed and Archelaus was to take his place. Though there was only one person that actually heard what the king said right before he died. So only one person that saw him sign that will. And all of a sudden, Archelaus was in charge. And some strange things started happening. I mean, things weren't great. People were living in poverty, on the brink of starvation, because they were being taxed and tithed to death over many, many years. They were already living under extreme oppression and persecution because they were not allowed to become full Roman citizens. And citizens of Rome enjoyed certain benefits that the rest of the population did not. There was a series of laws and policies, both officially written down and unofficially practiced, that kept those two groups separate. Now, there's a series of incidents that occurred under Herod and Archelaus that bear mentioning. At a certain point, Archelaus started appointing the high priest to the temple. Now, can you imagine if the king of the land appointed the head of the church? We have a word for that, right? That's the opposite of the separation of church and state, isn't it? Okay? So he went into the temple then, with full permission of the high priest, and started moving stuff around, started putting up his own symbols and emblems in the place of God. And certain people had a problem with this, but he did not want to listen to them. So at a certain point, a couple of professors and a bunch of youth, about 40 youth that were loyal to these professors, snuck in the middle of the night and took down those emblems. A minor protest. Archelaus had them hunted down and burned to death. Well, people started having a problem with this, and they started questioning him, and there started being some twittering, if you will, some rabble-rousing. And Archelaus started to get really concerned about this. And so he got so concerned that he was worried that coming up on Passover, which was a high holiday, that there might be some trouble brewing. Now, I know none of you have ever seen any trouble brewing right around a gigantic national holiday. But there was some trouble brewing. And Archelaus was concerned that these folks were going to try and overthrow him and his kingship because they were talking about how he had appointed the high priest who was corrupt and would allow these symbols in his church and or in his temple, and they were concerned about these deaths that had occurred when people had staged a very minor peaceful protest. So Archelaus sent out the National Guard. He sent out his army, his police force, to the temple the day before Passover, when people from all around had gathered. And maybe they were going to protest. Maybe they were going to just worship. Maybe they were going to pray. Maybe they were going to hold a candlelight vigil. We'll never know, because the army decided to declare war on them. 3,000 people died that day. Okay? So then Archelaus decides he wants to go to Rome, because even though he has got his father's will and most of the people are, the army is recognizing him as the official leader, he can't really be the official leader unless the Roman government says it's okay. So he had to go all the way to Rome to get that approval, to get that official stamp. And so he went, and a group of about 100 Jewish citizens followed him to protest, to tell the Roman governor, please don't make this man over us, ruler over us. He is corrupt. He is cruel, and he has already responded to people who protest him, to people who disagree with him through the death penalty. So we're going to ask you, please don't make him ruler over us. Well, the Roman governor knew this was exactly the kind of person he wanted in charge, because he would be able to keep down rebellions. He was totally okay with exploiting the poor and extracting as many taxes as possible. And he knew that he was loyal to the Roman government, not to the people, because he was ethnically aligned with the Roman government, not ethnically aligned with the Jewish population. So he was made king. He was made ethnarch. And he went back. He went back to Jerusalem. And guess what the first thing he did was? What? Go ahead. He killed the 100. So one of these incidents, you might say, well, it was a necessary police action. Three in a row, that's a systemic problem. Do you see it? Do you see the problem? When you have absolute power, zero accountability, and a systemic series of laws and policies that absolutely disenfranchise one segment of the population that is ethnically different from a different segment of the population. This is the political climate that Jesus was raised in. And when it says, when Jesus was, right after he was born, Mary and Joseph heard that Archelaus had been made ruler, they went to Egypt. They just got out of town. And they stayed there for quite some time until Archelaus died, before they were able to come back when Christ was a teenager. Do you remember that part? That's why. That's why they left, because they knew about Archelaus, they knew about the Herods, and they knew once he had been made ruler, officially sanctioned by Rome, they just needed to get out. They just needed to get out. So last year, a friend and I traveled to the southern United States. We went down to Louisiana. Our goal was to eat our way through the southern United States, to eat everything that was praline, deep-fried, hot-sauced, chitlined, all the way, crawdaded. It was delicious. My personal goal was to eat a different kind of okra every single day, and I just about made it. It was delicious. And as we were going up through Mississippi, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and then I flew into Richmond, Virginia, I saw some very interesting things. I went to the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. It's right next to Jefferson Davis's White House, where he used to live and where his offices were. And as I went to the Museum of the Confederacy, there were men outside that were of my ethnicity waving Confederate flags. Welcome, ma'am. Welcome to the Museum of the Confederacy. Big old flag. And as I went through that museum, there was signage on the walls. They had uniforms. They had old weaponry. They had pictures. They had excerpts from diaries from the soldiers of the Civil War. And again, they said what Northerners don't understand is that the Civil War was never about slavery. It was about maintaining our way of life. And there didn't seem to be any recognition that the way of life was slavery. The way of life, the life of leisure, the life of gentility, the life of being able to sit on a porch sniffing the magnolias, drinking sweet tea and big fluffy dresses was only possible because all of the hard work was being done by the slaves. And that has left a legacy in this country that we are continuing to see today. We are continuing to see this played out again and again and again. What we are seeing erupt in Ferguson is not the first time that this country has seen riots around great injustices that were done by the police. We've seen it in Watts multiple times. We've seen it during the Civil Rights Movement in Selma, in Birmingham, in Montgomery. And we're seeing it in Ferguson. So what's interesting about these stories and what's interesting about what we're seeing now is something that I've talked about before, which is this progression from polarization to dehumanization to demonization. Remember me talking about this? Some of you, you might have been sleeping during that sermon. That's okay. It's okay. But when you see two groups, it starts with polarization. We have the us versus them. And we saw that with Rome and with the Jewish people, where you saw, you know, an us versus them mentality. We're in charge. You're supposed to do what we say. We're different here. Then we see the dehumanization. That's the next step. We enjoy the benefits of citizenship. You don't get to enjoy all those benefits. You get a little less than, because you are a little less than. And we see that right now playing itself out again in Ferguson. We had polarization. There was already polarization. Then we saw the dehumanization. When we find out that it took months and months and months for those kids to take their senior photos because the entire school district only had 2 graduation gowns. That's how much poverty there was. They had to take turns borrowing the same 2 graduation gowns to take their pictures, so they had to start months in advance. There's a dehumanization there. When we see that a certain segment of the population lives in abject poverty, very little opportunities, crime-ridden streets, and another segment of the population doesn't. Now, that happens sometimes, but when you start seeing statements, as I have seen through media, through social media, talking about, well, they choose to live that way, they're just like that. Right? Well, if they would just quit being a bunch of criminals, those people, that stops being polarization and it starts being dehumanization, where one group is above and one group is below. The next step before we get to violence is demonization. And we saw that in the Roman Empire because Herod Archelaus, right before he sent in his troops to the temple, he didn't say, I think there's a bunch of peaceful protesters in there. I think there's some concerned citizens in there. I don't think there's some of our brothers and sisters who we might disagree with in there. He called them seditionists. That's demonization. It's the worst thing he could think of. People who are going to try and cause a bunch of trouble so they can overthrow me and secede from the Roman Empire. We've heard the word seditionist before in this country, haven't we? And it justified a whole lot of violence against a group of people. Not just liberating slaves, but extreme violence towards a group of people. And when I hear that Officer Wilson referred to the boy he killed as looking like a demon right before he shot him, that's demonization at its essence. It's a lot easier to be violent towards someone if you have demonized them. When you look at movies and you see the bad guys are always uglier than the good guys, they always have some sort of icky scar on them that makes them look a little more animalistic, or they're wearing a big scary mask so they look more like monsters. Hundreds of them can die in a single movie, and we cheer that on. It's a lot easier. It's a lot easier to justify that kind of a societal norm when we've reached the point of demonization. So, when I was in the South, I noticed there was a this side of the tracks and a that side of the tracks kind of thing going on. Where on one side of the tracks you would see really beautiful houses and homes, and on the other side you would see abject poverty, little shacks, little shanties, that still perpetuated that division from hundreds of years ago. The other thing I noticed was a certain level of fear and anxiety, which we don't necessarily sense as much here on the West Coast. But at a certain point, we stopped at a gas station, my friend and I. We stopped at a little gas station to get a snack, use the bathroom. And I went in the bathroom, and there was a little bit of a line. There was maybe three people in front of me, three other ladies, and one of them had a couple of small children. So I opened the door, and I came in, and they were facing the other way. They didn't see me. And the little girl that was standing right there, she was adorable. She was probably 5 or 6. She turned around, saw me, and jumped. She startled and backed away. I've never had a child do that before. But when she startled and jumped, her mother noticed and looked at me, and she said, oh, you can go ahead. Go ahead. No, go ahead. No, you go right ahead, ma'am. No, I'm waiting for the bathroom. There's a line, right? We all know what it's like to wait in line for the ladies' bathroom. At least the ladies here do. I'm sure you men have seen the line, right? We know what it's like to wait in line for the bathroom. No, you go right ahead. Because they didn't want any trouble. That's how palpable the fear still was. So, what do we do about this? This is the big question. As a mostly white church in a mostly white state, what do we do about this? It's hard to know, because this is something that is bigger than us. And what I've noticed is, I think that when people hear about slavery, when they see the problems and the legacy that it has left, it's overwhelming. It's a huge trauma. When we really see it, it's too much to take in. It's like losing a loved one. It's like going through some sort of horrible trauma. And it's too difficult for us to just absorb it and then fix it. And so when I look at the way people process this, it looks very much to me like the 5 stages of grief. Have you heard the 5 stages of grief? Right? We got denial. We got anger. We got bargaining. We got depression, and then we get to acceptance. And I think that to a large degree, based on what I've seen on social media and what I feel in myself and what I see when I talk to other people, is that we're in some of those stages, but we haven't gotten to acceptance yet. We've seen denial, right? We've seen denial around Ferguson. How many people have heard or seen someone say, I don't know what the big problem is. Slavery was like 200 years ago. I never owned any slaves. What's the problem? Right? That's denial. That's denial. And then there's the anger, right? Well, look at what that person said. That's just a bunch of reverse racism is what it is. And frankly, I resent the suggestion. That's anger. Then we get to the bargaining, phase. Well, maybe if I just don't behave like a bigot, then everything will be okay. Did you know there's a thing? There's a thing that white people do, that we smile. We smile at people of color. I didn't even know it was a thing until someone pointed it out to me. We smile. People that we don't know, if we're passing them in the street, we give them a big smile to let them know we're not one of those people. To let them know we're not threatening. To let them know we're not a bad person. That's bargaining. If I give you a big smile, then maybe you won't hate me, and then we can pretend like this isn't really a problem. It's a thing. It's a thing we do. You may not be aware of it, but we do it. We do it. And then there's the depression. When we hit rock bottom and we realize this is a huge problem, when we watch the news and we cry, how many people have reached it to the point of depression where we watch the news and we weep and we just say, why? This is so bad. This is so horrible. Why? And when you look at these five stages of grief, from denial to anger to bargaining to depression to acceptance, it looks very much like a 12-step program, doesn't it? Right? From denial to anger to bargaining to depression, when you hit rock bottom, when you find yourself laid out in jail, having lost all of your relationships, lost your job, sick to your stomach, drunk, and you realize you got no place to go, and it really hits you, you hit rock bottom. I think it's about time, to some degree, that America hits rock bottom, that we quit with the denial, with the anger, with the bargaining, and we hit rock bottom and recognize that this is real. This is very real. This didn't end 200 years ago. This didn't end with the passage of the Civil Rights Act. It's still happening. And it's big. And it's bigger than us. It's bigger than a smile can fix. It's bigger than simply trying to watch our language problem. This is an enormous systemic issue that affects every community. And it affects us. And once we get to that acceptance place, then and only then can we start talking about reconciliation and healing. Because if we go from denial to, oh, I can fix this, no, we can't. No, we can't. I think what's really hard for me personally is recognizing that I can't fix this. That even if I try my absolute best to be the nicest person I can, to give to the poor, to educate, to help, I can't fix this. There are laws and institutional policies and practices across this entire nation that are bigger than me, that have been going on for hundreds of years before I was even born. And just like with alcoholism or with drug abuse, we can find ourselves in a very crazy-making place where we realize that we have 100% of the responsibility to fix this, but we have almost zero control over it. And if you've ever found yourself in a situation where you have 100% of the responsibility and zero of control, that's when you start to get really, really nutty. So what do we do with all of this? What do we do with all of this? First of all, we sit with it. Acceptance is really important. Acceptance is really important. We cannot jump to reconciliation. We cannot jump to healing without dealing with all of these other issues of denial and anger and bargaining and depression. And so when we look at today's passages, when we look at the prophecies that are made, Joseph's prophecy that a child will be born called Emmanuel, which means God is with us. And when we look at Zechariah's passage, Zechariah's prophecy that says, one will come who will save us from our enemies and from those who hate us, he's not talking metaphorically. He's talking about a very real political situation that he has seen with his own eyes. Zechariah was old. He was in his 80s or 90s when he wrote this, when this happened. He had watched multiple generations grow up under this system and become disenfranchised. opportunities passed them up. Extreme poverty perpetuated, while other people who enjoyed citizenship got to skyrocket to the top and enjoy all sorts of wealth and benefits. It's really important to remember that when he talks about someone who will save us from the darkness and near certainty of death, he's not only talking very realistically, not metaphorically, but he's also writing from the minority perspective. Zechariah was in an ethnic minority in a gigantic, powerful empire. And he wrote these words of hope, the same words that Isaiah wrote when he was under attack by Babylon, which was doing the exact same thing. So what do we do with all of this on this first Sunday of Advent when we're supposed to be talking about presents and Christmas and happiness and lights and trees? What do we do with all of this? We recognize that all of the references to light are because there was extreme darkness. That there is a new dawn's light coming. But dawn only comes after a long night, where you have to face all those monsters in the closet and face all those monsters under the bed. So they put all their hope into a baby. All the way through the Old Testament, they talked about again and again the one who would come that would make things right, the one who would bring the hope, the one that would bring the reconciliation, the one that would bring the healing, the one that would take all that fear that leads to the polarization and the dehumanization and the demonization, all that fear, and remove it. That's why every time an angel says anything to anybody, the first thing they say is, "Fear not," because they know, just as we know, that when people are afraid, they do stupid and destructive things. And whenever you see someone doing stupid and destructive things, 99% of the time, they're afraid. And so, again and again, we hear, "Fear not." And our hope lies in something bigger than ourselves. Bigger than ourselves that can take all of that fear and remove it. Rip it off like a scab off our hearts so that we can see each other with love. And when we talk about Christ and his conquering of sin, you know, we're talking about real sin, not, "Oh, I stole a pack of gum when I was 10 from a five and dime store, but I went back the next week and slipped a quarter into the till, so I'm all cool with that now. I said something unfortunate to my good friend, but I apologize and they forgave me, so we're all good now." We're talking about sin that we can't fix. Societal sin, a gigantic systemic sin, something that's bigger and more powerful than us. The only thing that can fix it, the only thing that can fix it is a power bigger than us. You know, I refer to the 12-step programs, but the 12-step programs came from the Jesuit tradition, from a Christian tradition. The concept that once we can admit there's a problem bigger than us that we can't control, there is a power greater than ourselves that can help us fix it. We have to do our part. We have to do our part. We have to watch our language. We have to recognize our own part in this problem. And the fact that even if we disagree with it on a philosophical level, we are participating in it and we are benefiting from it, whether we like it or not, whether we admit it or not. And we have to turn it over. Advent is about waiting. Advent is about seeing a bigger problem, about sitting and waiting in the darkness and trusting that something better is going to occur that's not coming from our own best intentions. If we could solve this problem just by being nice people, just by working really hard, the problem would be solved by now. It's bigger than us. And so I'm going to share with you a prayer, a technique that I like to use. Many of you may already be familiar with it because I've talked about it before. But as we go through Advent, it would be very easy for me to just talk about lights and love and happiness. But Advent is about waiting. Advent is about listening. Advent is about hoping for a better world, a really better world. The kingdom that we keep hearing about, a place of peace, a place of justice, a place of love. And we're not there yet, despite our best efforts. And so I'm going to invite you to pray with me. I'm going to invite you to pray with me that we turn this over to God and ask God to help us to do the part that we can't do. And so we pray. We say, God, these are your people. This whole nation is your people. You promise us a kingdom of peace and of justice. And we want that too. But right now, we do not have a nation of peace, and we do not have a nation of justice. We have a broken nation. We have a polarized, dehumanized, demonized nation filled with violence and injustice. Whether we like it or not, whether we see it or not, whether it feels good to us to admit it or not, it's there. Help us to do our part. Help us to be aware. But we recognize this is bigger than us. It's so big for us that when we really acknowledge how big it is, it crushes our spirits. It overwhelms us. It paralyzes us. Help us to stay in this place of acceptance, God, where we truly see it. Help us to turn the lights on so we can really see it in all its reality. And because it's too big for us, and because you say that any burden we can put on your shoulders and you will help us carry it, we turn it over to you. We lay this burden right on top of your shoulders, because even though it's too big for us, nothing is too big for you. And so, Lord, we trust that this nation is in your capable hands. We trust that you are working through us and through other people to right these wrongs and to build your kingdom of justice and peace and love. And so as we enter this Advent season, Lord, we ask that you take care of this. And we're listening. We're here. We're accepting. We're listening. We're waiting. And if there's something you want us to do to be part of the solution, show it to us and make it really, really, really clear so we don't miss it, so that we can do our part, so we can take our action, so that we can truly be reflections of your light and your love in everything that we do, and everything that we say, and everything that we think. We trust, Lord, we trust that this is in your capable hands, but we also trust that we are being called to do our own part, that we're not going to stand idly by in denial or anger or depression or bargaining. We're going to stand in reality. We're going to stand for justice. We're going to stand for peace. We're going to stand most of all for love. We ask all of these things in the one who is coming, the one who is showing us the way, the one who is promising us the hope. Amen.